attorney, advocate, author, public speaker, The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600. Flip that switch and turn on your brain. Here is Lisa Wexler.
And Lisa has the day off. This is Ann Carrick. I am in for her today. We're switching topics now. We're going to talk more about your money. And joining us to do that is Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington from Gilman Hill Asset Management. And Jenny, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you. I know I spoke to you before a few weeks ago, and I never really got a chance to get a little background about what Gilman Hill Asset Management is all about. So before we jump into, you know, non-investment professionals dealing with market-moving headlines, as you called them, you know, give people a little background on how did Gilman Hill Asset Management come to be, and what is it that you all do, so that they know what we're talking about. Like when you give your comments, they'll understand from what point of view you're speaking.
Sure. Thanks. So I had spent my career at big firms, at Goldman Sachs and at Neuberger Berman, and while they were wonderful places to work and are wonderful firms and amazing training ground, I thought the opportunity to be at a boutique and really do things right, exactly the right way, and not have layers and layers of management and fees and conflicts of interest was a better way, was the best way to manage money for people. So in 2006, I went out on my own, joined Gilman Hill, bought my partners out in 2009, and fast forward 13 years, sorry, here we are. We manage just shy of $500 million, and we work with wealthy individuals managing their portfolios. So there's no layers between the individual and their portfolio. There's not a sales guy and a, you know, wealth management expert and the asset allocation expert and, you know, the portfolio manager. There's our clients, their portfolios, their stocks. And if they want to know what's going on, they can ask me directly, and they know exactly why each holding is in there, and they know what it's doing for them. And I think that all breeds a higher level of confidence. And I think the whole point of having money is to make you, and all the money you've saved is to make you feel secure.
Right.
And to know what's going on. And if you can feel like you know exactly what's going on in your portfolio and have it working for you and understand what the point is, I think it lifts the weight of the world off your shoulders. So sorry for the long-winded explanation, but
that's
the point
fine.
Of Gilman Hill.
So if I was working with you and you're managing my portfolio, I talk to you, we discuss what I'm trying to do or what I want, you make suggestions, and if I agree or I guess if I don't, but in other words, we decide what plan of action we're going to take, and then you go and do the purchasing or selling on my behalf for my portfolio.
Right. And one nuance on that. So we manage income-oriented portfolios, right? So all of our clients are coming to us with the idea of income generation.
Meaning now, they're trying to live off of what the money you're generating.
They're trying to live off of it, or they're a person who likes to see money constantly coming back into their portfolio as reassurance that that it's really working for them.
Okay.
So if you were to come to me, Ann, and you're like, look, I'm 27 years old. I just want to grow. I want to shoot the lights out. Then I'd say to you, I'm not the right fit for you, but I can help you figure out who is.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. And then I know when I spoke to you before, you kind of gave some, you said like different boutique asset management companies sort of have different income, not income levels, but like amounts of money that would be like the minimum in order to work with them, right?
Right, exactly.
So can you tell us what yours is, or is that like not public information?
It's public, but it's really high, and I hate scaring people off, but our stated minimum is about $5 million per account.
Well, you did say you were working with high wealth individuals, so that would make sense.
Right. But then we work with, for example, we work with a firm in upstate Connecticut called Essex Financial Services, and they do a terrific job, and their clients don't need to have that same cutoff. So then they could go to Essex and then access our strategy through Essex.
So if somebody doesn't have $5 million to invest, you might say go to Essex and they're still getting input from you.
Right.
Or indirectly.
Like Janney is another firm that we work with, or we work with RBC. So there's lots of other firms that can take care of, I hate saying it this way, but like the smaller portfolio level. And then that way they can be serviced really, really well. But our focus is on the portfolio level, not 100% on the client service level.
Got it. All right. Well, it makes sense if you're small and you're a boutique that if you're dealing with like type clients, then you're really focused on what's best for that type of client rather than trying to know everything for every scenario.
Exactly. Exactly. And so we've got that dividend income focus.
Right. Okay. And I, that was another thing I didn't get to follow up on. You made a comment once before, which about a company that, and the comment was that their dividends were small and they weren't US based. So it wasn't a good option for you because your company is focusing on investments that generate dividends at some level, correct?
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Our goal is to create a portfolio where let's say it's $1 million just for rounding error and you're getting 55,000 of income a year from that portfolio. Our goal is to say, look, the market can be up 20%, down 20%, whatever, and that 55,000 is coming to you no matter what. So not many companies fit the bill for that portfolio.
Right. So it's not that there was anything wrong with the company. It was just
Absolutely
it didn't
not.
Match what you're trying to do for your clients.
Exactly.
It was a different type of investment.
We have a very niche goal in the kind of companies that we're investing in. It's that bomb-proof dividend income stream.
Okay. I think that's helpful for people to know, if nothing else, if they're going to look for someone to help them, to realize that different places focus on different things so that they ask those questions when they try to meet with somebody, like what's your strategy here? Does it fit with what I want to do?
Right. And it's funny because when you go to the bigger firms, like the large institutional firms, they do have more breadth. But I had a friend who is meeting with one recently, and we were laughing that everything he asked, what are the performance returns? What are the investment fees? The salesperson kept saying, it depends, it depends, it depends, it depends, So it's then on the client or on the prospective client to really narrow and focus their questions to get to what each different firm's expertise are. And I think that's incredibly difficult to ask the right questions.
Right. All right. So let's before we chew up the entire time talking about boutique firms, I think it's very interesting, but since I sort of promised people we're going to talk about something else, So, one of the things I had asked you about, in the news recently, of course, with the attacks on Saudi Arabia's oil processing facilities, and everybody's talking about the global markets and how it's going to affect them and gas prices. So one of the things that you mentioned was, for someone who's not an investment professional, all these headlines come out of the news, and you think, oh, my God, I should do something, but I don't know what to do. So let's talk a little bit about maybe in general that one, since it's fresh off the presses, as far as it just happened, how is that likely to impact someone's investments or their day-to-day life? Gas prices is usually what everybody talks about. But in general, how do you handle news that could affect your investments?
So this is the perfect example, right? There's one a month of these, kind of something that'll grab the headlines and scare people. So my husband and I work together, but he is not a professional investor, right? He runs the operational side. And so he came to me on Saturday morning and he said, Jen, did you see these headlines? The Saudi pipelines just got bombed and I just read that oil is going to be $100 by the end of the week. And he was scared. He was scared with what that meant for us as we fill up our car, for what it meant for the portfolios, for what it meant for what was going to happen Monday morning when our clients started calling in. And I immediately said to him, what was the source, right, of the $100 headline? And he said, I don't know.
Right.
And I'm like, well, let's look at the source. And so I think when you have these scary headlines, whether they're the Saudi pipeline being bombed or whether it's Trump just put 10% on $300 billion more of tariffs, I think it's super critical to diversify the sources that you're listening to and try to give yourself a well-rounded perspective on what's going on. Because if you wanted to go right now and say, I think we're headed for Armageddon, and for the worst recession in history, and you Google worst recession in history coming, I am quite positive you'd find hundreds of compelling articles.
Absolutely.
Likewise, if you wanted to Google, bull market for the next decade, I am sure you could find hundreds of compelling articles.
Yes, right? You could.
Yeah. So it's really, really critical to not respond and react to those headlines. And I thought it was interesting too. Yesterday, my partner Greg and I were hashing through, oil's up 15%, now 10%, whatever, huge move, biggest move in X amount of years. What does this really mean? Does this really mean that there's a problem to the global supply chain? And the answer is no. And what does it mean? What it meant was that it was almost like people writing a call option on future disruptions. And for whoever, you know, allegedly bombed that pipeline to say, hey, that was easy. And look at how much impact it made quickly.
Right.
And, you know, and will those pick up? But you can see today oil is down 6%, which is the investment investment community stepping back and saying, all right, there's not much disruption. No, it's
right.
not likely to happen again. But if you'd made decisions yesterday morning or spent your Saturday and Sunday panicked,
right.
you know, and in a tizzy over it, how much time would you have wasted and how much money might you have lost yesterday morning? So I always think step back, stay rational,
yeah.
keep your eye on the horizon. Here's the horizon. The horizon is over the past 20 years, over the past 5 years, the market's returned an average of about 8%. What's it likely to return over the next 20 years? Probably an average of 8%. Like a million people could argue with me about that, right? But I can argue strongly in favor of it. And by the way, the past 20 years, average 8% includes the worst financial collapse and recession that any of us are likely to experience in our investing lifetimes. And
right.
it still is an average of 8%.
8%, right.
Yeah, just chill, relax, look
yeah.
at the long-term horizon.
On this particular one, I suspect gas prices will go up at the pump, if nothing else, because they can justify because everyone's expecting it.
You know,
which is
sure
a little different than
back down though.
Yeah, I know, but you know, yeah. I'm just saying. You know, I think sometimes, like you know, stations or chains will feel like well they can bump it up a little bit because everyone's expecting it. You know, like when there's a hurricane that goes through the Gulf of Mexico. And they have to shut down operations for a few days and, you know, all the prices bump up or something.
I think you're absolutely right. I just don't think it's going to be catastrophic or that big.
I think
they'd be hard-pressed given how short-lived this was. But if there's another bombing or two and it becomes more scary, then totally they're going to take advantage of that.
Sure. And I have to say, as someone who works on the media side, not just here doing talk shows at WICC, but, you know, doing news in other places, I tell people all the time that if you really want to be informed, it's best if you visit more than one reputable source. You know, in other words, like, mm-hmm. you know, even if you're a fan of one over the other, listen to some other ones and just see if they're all saying the same thing. And if they're not, then listen carefully to see, you know, they're giving you a different perspective on the same story. Listen to why and see where do you think the truth is, you know, because as when I'm working in the newsroom, I see so much more information than I have time to
right.
to turn around and give back out. You know, we try to summarize it as best we can, but there's always more information that doesn't get. You know, I mean, I work in radio, so if I'm doing a newscast, I'm trying to summarize it for you as quickly and clearly and in simple terms as I can. But there's been a lot more information that went into that story, and I can't get it all to you. And so, if you listen to someone else on some other outlet and they summarize it slightly differently, you might pick up a tidbit that I didn't think was as important, and they jumped on that, and you'll just get a better perspective of the whole story. You know, so
absolutely.
I agree with you on that.
And it's really cool. So I get this morning research report from J.P. Morgan, and one of the best parts of it is they summarize the most impactful market or the most impactful news stories that are out there that morning. But I love reading it because they take from Politico and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. So it forces me to diversify my thinking as
right.
an investor. And I think staying broad in your thinking is one of the best things that you can do for yourself.
Yeah. And you know what? When I'm on my way to work, even I look at different news apps that pull stories from all different sources because I just want to see what's everybody talking about, not just
right.
what, you know, where I work. No, not just what we're going to focus on, but what's everybody talking about, because I don't want to miss anything either. If I'm the one who's supposed to be giving you the news, I want a better understanding of what's everything that everybody's talking about, because I'm going to have to whittle it down. But you're going to if I start with a full basket, then I at least know which ones I'm picking, you know.
Right. That's funny.
As opposed to just having two items and say, okay, that's it.
Right.
Yeah. So when you go back to the question of controlling somebody's behavior and not being derailed by headlines, that's kind of what we're talking about is, so you're saying check more than one source, don't hit the panic button. I assume if they're working with someone, it doesn't make sense to call, like if I'm your client, does it make sense to get in touch with you and say, hey, what do you think about what's going on? Is that kind of an option for everybody depending on who they're working with.
Here's the thing. If it's not an option for everybody, it should be. Because whether they're working with Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab or T. Rowe or me, right, there's 1,000 people sitting there, the customer service rep, and they're sitting there waiting to have those conversations. And I always tell my clients, I would much rather you call me if you're panicking, because if I'm not panicking, I may not know that you're panicking.
Right.
I would much rather you call me 10 times rather than on the 11th time you'd be in a full meltdown, you know, on the 11th time that you wanted to call and didn't, that you'd be in a full meltdown. I would much rather have the conversation along the way. I'd much rather say, here's why I don't think a recession's coming. You know, here's why I think we're going to be okay for the next year and a half, and have that rational conversation in an ongoing manner. It's going to help me manage your portfolio better, and it's going to make you a better client and help you make rational decisions, which is going to make you a lot richer in the end.
Right. We're going to take a quick break because we have to. And then when we come back, you touched on recession. I want to get your take on it. I know that you love to talk about recessions, but also, you know, but is it just being used as a political bantering point, or is, you know, what are the reasons someone should be worried about a recession or not? But we'll come back to that in just a minute. So we're going to take a quick break here on the Lisa Wexler Show, and we'll come back and continue speaking with Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington. And welcome back. Ann Carrick in today for Lisa. She has the day off. We are talking to Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington from Gilman Hill Asset Management. And we also have a phone call from Ferris from West Myrtle Beach. And so, Jenny, we're gonna ask Ferris what he's calling about first, and then we'll come back to the recession. So, Ferris, you said you had a comment regarding the passing of Cokie Roberts as well as speeches in South Carolina last night. What's up?
Good day, Ann. I have not had the pleasure of speaking with you before.
Well, thank you. It's nice to have you call in. What's going on in South Carolina?
Your voice is very resonant.
Thank you.
South Carolina, last night, is the place of the oldest stump speeches in our great nation, our once great nation. Now, we are going to make America great again, but right now we have to say our once great nation. And there's a little town near Myrtle Beach, which is where I am sitting right now, called Gallivant's Ferry. Gallivant's Ferry, for all you Googlers out there.
And
Gallivant's Ferry had the speeches last night by the Democrat Socialists. All came to Gallivant's Ferry. I should not say all.
Ferris, I need you to pick up the pace here on the question, because we're a little short on time.
You want me to pick up the pace? Do you want me to talk faster?
No, I want you to tell me what the point is of what you're trying to tell us, as opposed to all your political commentary.
I'm informing you and your listeners of what occurred last night in Gallivant's Ferry, and that is speeches by a guy named Biden, believe it or not, running for president.
Right.
Another candidate named Buttigieg, Buttigieg.
Buttigieg.
I'm saying that. Thank you very much. And a couple others. But while they were talking in Gallivant's Ferry, making national news, and it was covered by the Nationals this morning, because it is the first in the country, the oldest, there's a lot of history involved in Gallivant's Ferry, South Carolina. And what occurred while they were having their gig, Liz Warren just had her escalator moment, and she has taken off with the nomination by her speech in New York City. Last night in the square called Washington Square in New York, those of you who have been to New York probably know Washington Square. And she took it all last night. And when the Obamas go on the ticket with her, you have an unstoppable Democratic ticket of Warren with Obama. Barack Obama will be there with Michelle Obama. You see, you get one, you get both. And this is unstoppable, all right? They cannot be beaten in the 2020 election. And if you heard Liz Warren's speech last night, as I did, it was published live and broadcast live on C-SPAN, where you get raw news and don't have to listen to commentators and info babes and stuff like that. You would have heard a speech. It was colossal, Ann. It was what I call her escalator moment. It was like the moment that
you think it pushed her out in front of the crowd?
Without a doubt. And more than that, the important thing is you can go out now and place your bets. And I just published this on the Ferris Wheel of Great News. It's a guaranteed deadlock cinch. You can go bet with the odds makers in Las Vegas on who's going to win this thing. You make a lot of money now by putting an early bet in that it is going to be And you could tell from her speech last night, it was exhilarating. She had the crowd whipped up. She's able to whip up a crowd. See, that's the key. That's what the others can't do. And when she comes in with Barack Obama, Michelle Obama as vice president.
Okay, I don't think Michelle or Barack Obama are running for vice president.
Well, what you think is probably less important than what I think.
You think so?
Yeah.
Why is what you think more important than what I think?
Because I'm the world's number one most often and most widely heard caller broadcaster in talk radio.
Okay. Well, Ferris, we appreciate that phone call and sharing his opinion. If you want to know more about him, I guess you can go search for him online. We're going to get back to Jenny Van Leeuwen because I promised that Jenny was going to talk to us about recession. So, Jenny, you're still there, correct?
I'm still here.
Okay. So, a little bit of a distraction there, but, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. So,
no worries, but you know what? He brings up the good point of that you need to diversify your sources on who you listen to, because if you were listening to all the mainstream media the night before the 2016 election, you would have thought it would be a landslide for Hillary also.
Absolutely.
You know, and then I'm sitting there in bed, putting my kids to sleep and watching the elections go in the opposite direction and then staying up until 3 a.m. writing a note to my clients about why the world wasn't going to fall apart when it turned out Hillary didn't win.
Right, exactly. Well, and you know, Ferris apparently has his own news source that he likes to give out news and his opinion. And so that's a source people can check if they feel like that's an important source that they want to know his opinion.
Yeah, and it's one single source.
Exactly. Which goes to both of our points, that if you really want to know, it's best if you check multiple sources and then draw your own conclusion.
Right.
So,
and don't get scared along the way.
Exactly. Recession. So regarding recession, is that being bounced around mostly as a political banter point because everybody's running for president, meaning that we have a lot of candidates at the moment? And if it's not really a concern, what would be the things where somebody should say, ooh, that does look like a recession coming?
Okay, so I think it was interesting that you went straight for the political side of the usefulness of using recession as a fear tactic, because I always think of the fear tactic of recession being used as a sales tool.
Ooh.
So I think like the sales guys, all the investment advisors who are desperate for your account and want you to be their client, they are constantly hawking recession coming, blah, 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 because if they can scare you into thinking that a recession's coming, you are more likely to move your account from where it is now to their wonderful, unique, you know, strategy that's going to protect you. If
the recession-proof strategy.
Right, right. But if they're saying like, oh, hey, the world's great, you know, you're fine, I don't think we're going to have a recession for the next 2 years, you're much less likely
Interesting.
To move. Right? So it's a fear tactic on both sides. On the political side, it's the same thing. Move from the Trump administration to the, you know, whichever Democrat, because recession's coming and he's running the world into the ground and blah, blah, blah. So that's a fear tactic there. And then it's a fear tactic on the sales side of you know, investment advisors trying to get you to use your, move your money. And I think the same thing, it's a recession every day. You know, we're one day closer to the next recession. Do I think we have anything like 08, 09 coming? No way. Do I think it's imminent? No way. Do I think when we have our next recession, do I think it'll be a long lived? Actually, no. And that's a whole, like, you know, 5-hour diatribe on my part on why I think the next recession will be
We'll
very,
have to
very
reschedule
short.
You for that one.
Yeah.
Right.
I might need a soapbox. But I don't think there's a huge recession coming. And I think that what you need to look at, I think the A number one thing to watch for is unemployment changing. I think that might be where the Fed starts to really start to worry about recession, too.
So, like, if
unemployment...
If unemployment is soaring, like more people are losing jobs and the Fed is talking about changing rates, then we start paying attention.
Don't worry about the changing rates.
Oh.
Worry about jobs. That'll be the thing that really starts to say, like, hey, maybe there is something wrong. And right now, unemployment's low. Wage growth is high. We're in really good shape right now.
Okay. Well, I'm going to end on that, Jenny, because that makes people feel better that we're in really good shape right now.
No. We're not booming. We're just really solid.
Okay.
Yeah, don't buy into the fear-mongering. That's, I think, most important.
All right. Don't buy into fear-mongering. Check multiple sources and not just rely on one. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Jenny, from Gilman Hill Asset Management. And you can check out her website, gilmanhill.com, if you want to know more about that. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Ellen Morehouse about government corruption and what's being done to try to reverse that trend right here on WICC 600.
We are witnessing a total political system failure in America. If you're anything like me, you may find yourself constantly overwhelmed by everything that's wrong with politics. And when I say politics, I'm not talking about Democrats or Republicans. I'm talking about the flaws that exist in our political system, regardless of which party is in power. And I know it's hard to talk about politics these days, but look, the government is ours. We pay for it, so it needs to work for us. And right now it doesn't. And I mean, it really doesn't. So what's going on here? Is it Russian meddling in social media? Is it him? Is it her? No. Those two were the least popular presidential candidates since they began keeping track of such things. Only 4% of Americans have a great deal of confidence in Congress now. Just 4%. America is no longer even considered a full democracy. We are witnessing a total political system failure in America, which is the complete opposite of what our nation's founders had in mind.
That was Jennifer Lawrence speaking in a video put out by represent.us. And our guest now, Alan Morehouse, is going to talk to us more about what's going on at a grassroots level to try to undo corruption that most of us feel frustrated that we feel like we can't really affect change within our own government, which, of course, was not what the founding fathers had in mind. And Ellen, thank you for being here.
And thanks so much for having me.
So I'm sure you're very familiar with that video since it came from your organization.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to hear it played like that.
Well, I have some other cuts that I took because, you know, where I there's certain parts of it where I thought it really drives home a point that I see that I don't always know that other people recognize. But before we get to that, tell people what represent.us is doing, like what are you trying to do so that they know what's the objective is?
So Represent Us is the nation's largest left-right anti-corruption organization. We have chapter leaders and volunteers in cities and states across the country, each working to sort of fix our broken political system on the local level, right where they are. And the sort of strategy there being is that local change ultimately drives federal change. So the long-term goal is to tackle corruption at a federal level through the states.
Okay. Now that sounds so simple, but it's not quite that simple, is it?
No, oh, you got it. Corruption can feel so huge, right? We see it in our everyday lives, but we either don't know how to enumerate the problem or even where to begin tackling it, definitely.
Okay. So I'm going to have Christian, our producer, play cut number 4, because I think this is also part of what has slowed down the process. Christian, hit number 4 for us. All right, he's queuing that up. But this is about the conversations that have been taking place and why they are not perhaps working quite as well as they would.
Yeah. So fixing this problem is possible, but how do we create our trigger moment for this issue? Well, the grassroots campaign from the study, that's Represent Us. We're bringing conservatives and progressives together to pass anti-corruption laws all across America using 3 strategic innovations: right-left coalitions, calling out corruption, and building a movement, a big movement. And I'm going to break them down for you.
Can I do this part?
No. First, right-left. This is how people self-identify in America. This isn't party identification. This is how you feel politically. And as you can see, it's 25% liberal, 36% conservative, and 34% moderate. But for the past 40 years and the reforms I've outlined, it's liberals speaking to liberals using liberal language with liberal messengers. Liberal. I just had to say that one more time. And you're just not going to change the political power structure of America with 25% of the people. Fixing corruption requires that we enlist all Americans, liberal, conservatives, and moderates, who, as we've shown, overwhelmingly support reform. Number 2, corruption. When we talk about money in politics, gerrymandering, democracy, campaign finance reform, most people just tune out. But people are fired up about corruption. And number 3, we must build a movement, a big movement, comprised of all kinds of people from all across America fighting to pass anti-corruption laws, and then make sure they are implemented and protected.
So, Ellen, again, I think that sums up a lot of what you're trying to do, correct?
Yes, definitely. I really love those 3 points. It sort of drills it down right to the nitty-gritty, gets right to the point.
Right. And obviously, you know, I'm taking audio from a video where she says, as you can see, but she does say it that, you know, 25% of the people consider themselves liberal, you know, and then you have all the moderates and the conservatives. So you can't have 25% of the people speaking to each other expecting to make some sort of global change.
That's right.
It sounds so obvious that you need to have policies and ideas that everybody can get on board with and move in one direction, because 25% conservative, liberal, whatever, can't get the other 75% to follow along. That doesn't usually work.
Absolutely.
So, all right. So at the grassroots level, we said that's what you're working on. How do you actually make this happen? I know, and I watched that whole video, which if people want to see it, you can just search Jennifer Lawrence and represent.us and you'll probably find it. It's about a 12-minute video. So it has a lot of interesting points in it. But it also points out how there are things that have started at the state level and then became federal. And the three that I kind of jotted down were women's right to vote, interracial marriage, and same-sex marriage. Those are all things that started at a state level. And then, you know, as they gained popularity and the general public was on board with it, they became federal laws.
Yes. So the study that Unbreaking America quotes is actually a Bloomberg study called This Is How Fast America Changes Its Mind. And what it goes through and references is literally the phenomena of grassroots movement. And it quotes an actual figure. 3.5% of a population engaged in sustained activism becomes a tipping point or maybe a key event. Maybe it's a court decision or this grassroots campaign reaching maturity that triggers this rush of state activity that ultimately leads to federal change. So we know that our strategy to achieve this change is ultimately rooted in just state-based history, right?
Right.
All of these, you know, nations changes throughout every time, from the legalization of interracial marriage to prohibition. And sometimes they even use open carry laws for our more conservative members, right? Have all started by passing laws in cities and states across the U.S. Local people tend to know what works best for their municipality or state.
Which is part of the reason our government is structured so that state and local people get to make decisions for their own area, because that's who knows their area best.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But if it's sort of corrupted by an undue influence of either special interests or lobbyists, or quite frankly, 2018 was the most expensive midterms on record, right? $5.19 billion.
Right.
Who is the incentive to actually listen to the people or the ones lining their pockets?
Right. So when you're talking about corruption, how do you start attacking that or fixing it, I should say? Attacking sounds aggressive. How do you start fixing that at a state or local level?
So the strategy was to have 11 million people watch the video. But now we sort of realize that the strategy is to get 11 million people to act. And that looks like this huge grassroots movement that you're talking about. The left, the right, the center coming together to tackle these issues. And I'll drive it home maybe with an anecdote in North Dakota. There were two women, and believe it or not, they are self-proclaimed, I'm not even sure if I can say this on the radio, badass grandmas.
Too late now.
A Democrat and a Republican woman who came together to tackle ethics in North Dakota.
Okay.
North Dakota was one of seven states that didn't have an ethics commission, sort of the booming oil industry just greasing down the same politicians regulating them on the EPA. And they formed a coalition to come together across the aisle to establish a 13-member independent body, right? No political nuance to it.
Right.
And they were ultimately successful. They were fought tooth and nail by the establishment, but as a result of their effort in North Dakota, the future landscape is forever changed. So what may seem as these wonky political, who really wants to discuss ethics commissions? Well, in the grand scheme of things, it's things like campaign finance reform and even more wonky electoral reforms like gerrymandering and
right.
choice voting that can change the landscape of how we vote, who we elect, and then how they serve once they get there.
Let me throw out another example for you, one that I hear often, not only in the newsroom talking to each other, but certainly when I do talk shows. And that is, like, when people talk about health care and the Affordable Care Act, you know, and so many people say, we think that elected officials should be on the same plan they're proposing for the general public as opposed to on their own special fancy plan. Is that something that could start at a local level also, where you start to insist that local officials work with the local, like that they have to pick a policy off the local exchange that their state offers?
Sure. I mean, certainly, whatever resonates most and makes the most sense to be able to relate to the common people that they're actually serving, right? Public servant isn't just this sort of term pie in the sky. They must represent those that they come from.
So in Connecticut, for example, instead of elected officials having the Connecticut state plan, if we said, no, they have to pick one of the exchange plans, that would be something we could start, say, at a state level. And then if each state sort of did that, then you could maybe turn it to a federal level where you say, okay, federal employees also have to go with one of the government-run plans.
I think that's a great example of how this strategy can work in practice.
Okay, only because that's one that people talk about a lot. You know, people complain about the corruption, but the healthcare is something they all participate in. They have to choose. They have to find a plan. So that was why I brought that one up. So from a corruption standpoint, your example in North Dakota, is that sort of what you're looking for other areas to do, is to create some sort of coalition to look at corruption and try to clean it up at a state level to start?
Absolutely. There are some campaigns we're already beginning to track in terms of 2019 and even 2020 elections. Massachusetts, for example, is pursuing a ballot initiative for something called ranked choice voting, which would change the way that we vote. And so some of these, you know, more wonky political reforms, as they bubble up, our members in different states across the country begin to either lead, create the initiative, support a partner initiative, and collaborate in that way. Sort of whatever it takes to get plugged in to the movement to drive change.
So if somebody's listening saying, you know, okay, this sounds good, like I want to be part of this, what's the first step you'd like them to do?
Plug in. So we have a national organizing platform, and if they go to our website, represent.us/chat, they can join. And there's actually different channels by state. And you can get plugged in where you live and figure out what sort of issues are going on in your backyard, or maybe raise an issue that no one else has thought or considered yet, and begin to talk with other people that you might have not had the chance to interact with before and learn what they're trying to tackle or what movement is already out there.
Okay. We have to take one more quick break, and then we'll come back and give you, like, the final word on this whole issue, okay? All right, so we'll take a quick break here at WICC 600.
Every voice matters. Your voice matters. If you do nothing, nothing changes. But if we all do a little, we can win together. So the only question left is this. Will you cross that line? Join us at represent.us.
And that is exactly who we're talking to right now, Ellen Morehouse with represent.us. I'm Ann Carrick in for Lisa Wexler today. She has the day off. So Ellen, I think that's probably one of the points, right? Get involved.
You got it. Right. Everyone knows the political system is broken, but what most people don't know is that there is a solution. And it really does start with getting plugged in, talking to each other. You know, I can't tell you how many times folks have been like, well, my very conservative mother, you know, if you truly believed in drain the swamp, our president was onto something there. We're truly talking about the same issues, and there's a seat for you at the table. So it's time to sort of cross these party lines and begin to tackle these issues in a pragmatic, realistic way.
Will people see a result sort of quickly when they get involved, even if it's only at the local level? Because I think part of what's frustrating people now is they just feel helpless. Like they see the things that are going on. They don't like the way it's happening, but they don't feel like anything that they're going to do as an individual is going to change anything.
I feel that. It does resonate. And institutions are slow, right? Reversing this trajectory, restoring the public faith and the power of self-governance, it does take time, but I would actually look to the 2018 elections, the most historic on record, 23 anti-corruption wins in cities and states across the country. So just this past fall, we just saw an unprecedented change. And so I would only encourage folks to ride that momentum forward. And you can check out the website represent.us/wins and see where those states were, what's happening, and see what's next, because it'll truly be here faster than they think.
And I want to reiterate again that you're saying represent.us is not, it's not Democrats, it's not Republicans, conservatives, moderates, liberals. It's supposed to be for everyone, right?
You got it. Our biggest tagline is serving conservatives, progressives, and everyone in between.
Okay.
Quite frankly, the two-party system is failing Americans, and we're leaving the major parties in droves. It actually no longer represents how we feel politically or even how we vote. So we're trying to sort of pursue these election reforms that can more accurately bring policy issues to the forefront, things that really affect average Americans' everyday lives, instead of sort of vying for these hyper-partisan and gridlocked voting blocks where sort of no one party can win by themselves. So we're trying to build the bigger tent and build a coalition across party lines that can make the change we need to see.
Yeah, I've heard other people say we need to get rid of the parties, and I said, that sounds good, but even if you did, people with like ideas would sort of regroup into, even if it's not an official party, because that's just kind of how people are. I've often said maybe a true viable third party would break the deadlock between the two, because at least if it was split three ways, now somebody would have to work with somebody to have a majority to get anything done. Do you know what I'm saying? Whereas right now it's just like there's like butting heads and nothing moves forward. They just kind of keep ramming into each other.
Yeah, and briefly earlier I talked about ranked choice voting happening in Massachusetts by an organization called Voter Choice MA. And actually one of the biggest arguments for that electoral reform is that it would allow more independent candidates to run and viably win, sort of breaking that broken two-party duopoly. So
can you explain that in a few minutes for what ranked? Go ahead.
You rank your choices every day, right? So it's sort of no different from that. You'd walk into the ballot and however many choices there are, you'd put, instead of just a winner take all, you vote for one and leave, you would actually rank them down the line. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And people say maybe it would make their vote not count, but what it does is that if the bottom choice, the lowest vote getter is eliminated, and if you voted for that, your vote then goes to your second choice, on and down the line until one candidate wins with a majority, over 50%. So even if it was your second or third choice, it was a candidate that you thought was viable enough to indicate that way.
Right, and as opposed to your sixth choice who wins because it was an A or B choice, right?
You got it. And, you know, if you look to the 2016 as a clear election, maybe you didn't want Hillary, you voted for President Trump. Maybe you didn't want the president, you voted for Hillary. Well, maybe you really wanted Bernie, or you wanted Jill Stein, or you wanted some sort of independent third party, and you sort of, it's called the spoiler effect, spoiling a party in either way. So to sort of break that and allow more choice and to accurately express your choice as a voter, maybe you get to pick your first choice as Bernie, even though you know it's a, quote, throwaway. You know, and I don't mean it in that way, but like...
Right, even if you don't think he's going to win, I still can put him down as my first choice.
That's my number one.
And if he doesn't win, then my second choice is, you know...
I guess I would be happy with so-and-so, choice B or choice C. And it actually encourages the politicians, the candidates themselves, to be more civil. You know, vie for your second choice. Research actually shows that it increases civility when campaigning.
Right.
They're less likely to disparage the other partner.
Yeah. And what do you think the prospects are in Massachusetts for that happening based on, from your organization's standpoint?
So just now, the organization leading that coalition, Voter Choice MA, is actually beginning the ballot initiative process. They have to gather hundreds of thousands of signatures in the next 90 days. And I think it's actually viable. There's a huge grassroots movement behind them. People are plugging in, signing their name. And I really think people are just sort of tired of the same old broken status quo. So instead of sort of remaining cynic in that way, they're actually ready and willing to step up and put their name out there and say, I'd like to see something change. You know, we've had a decade of this stagnancy. What's coming next, right? It's not about any political party or any particular president or administration for that reason. Like, Congress itself has just sort of been broken and mired in gridlock. We're not seeing any action.
Do you think the ranked choice voting system is that a big step forward if that became federal, for example? Do you think that would solve a lot of the issues just to, out of the box?
I think it's a yes and situation. Ranked choice voting is one policy of many that can help fix this broken system. Well, I'd also love to see a campaign finance reform and so many other reforms along those ways that can help fix. So yes, and so much more to come.
Okay. So Ellen Morehouse, again, thank you very much. If you want to know more about this, represent.us. And she mentioned several /chat/win, depending on what you want. I'm Ann Carrick, in for Lisa Wexler today on WICC 600. Thanks for being here. And again, it's all on the podcast. If you missed part of the show, go listen online. Thanks. Have a great day.